Hi, I'm Beth Gibbs, and every week at this time, Chris takes a look at the current issues of For Your Health. Our first article is titled, A Trick to Reduce Stress? Spend 20 seconds a day doing this easy practice by Deborah Netburn for the Tribune News Service. Eli Sussman was a fairly experienced meditator when he attended a month-long retreat at Plum Village, a Buddhist monastery in southern France, in 2017. The UC Berkeley PhD candidate in clinical science had been on other retreats where participants spent most of their time meditating. So he was surprised when he saw that the daily Plum Village retreat schedule included only 30 minutes of formal seated meditation a day. Midway through the retreat, he decided to extend one of his sessions, sitting beneath a tree for 3 hours. Later, he ran into a monk named Brother Treasure and told him about his practice. The monk's response was not what he expected. 3 hours? Sussman remembers Brother Treasure telling him with a smile. How about 3 breaths? That's all it takes to step into the present moment. The word stuck with Sussman. It led him to wonder whether an abbreviated practice that takes no more than a few breaths can make a difference in someone's life. 7 years later, he and his colleagues at Berkeley's Golden Bear Sleep and Mood Research Clinic have evidence that it might. Earlier this year, they published a paper online in the journal Behavior Research and Therapy that describes how a simple 20-second self-compassion micro-practice lowered stress levels and improved the mental health of undergraduate volunteers who did it every day for a month. Quote, two of the biggest barriers people have for developing a meditation habit is having the time to do it and developing the habit of doing it regularly, said Sussman. Micro-practices are like tiny training sessions that are based on the most potent parts of therapeutic practices. Sussman then described the practice that he developed for the study and explained how anyone can use it to try to feel better in less than 1 minute a day. Quote, the instructions we gave were to close your eyes and call to mind something about yourself that has been bothering you and making you feel unworthy, unloved, or not enough, and notice what arises in the body. Then we asked people to send kindness and warmth to themselves by placing one hand over the heart and another over the belly with the energy of giving themselves a big hug and notice what arises in the body now. Next, we invited them to ask themselves, how can I be a friend to myself in this moment? Finally, we told them to open their eyes when they were ready. And doing this for 20 seconds a day really made a difference in the lives of the study participants, the reporter asked. Yes, but it only worked for people who practiced it regularly. In our study, we looked at the subset of people who practice daily and at the whole sample of people who were given the instruction. More frequent practice was associated with greater increase in self-compassion and a greater reduction in stress and mental health problems, like symptoms of depression or anxiety, compared to a control group. Well, what are some of the ways that people can send kindness and warmth to themselves? The key phrase we used in the study was, how can I be a friend to myself in this moment? What we meant by that is imagine you were seeing a friend or your younger self in a similar situation, and you were being really caring to that friend. What would you tell them to do? How would you ask them to be? You can also imagine yourself receiving unconditional love from someone like a mentor, a parent, or a close friend. How would they relate to you in this moment of suffering? Is there a way you can give that same compassion to yourself? Well, does it matter where people do this practice? We didn't look at that, but that's a great question. Why is it helpful for people to touch their stomach and chest while doing the exercise? There has been so much work on touch and how beneficial it can be for people to receive touch, but it had not been looked at as a standalone intervention for emotional well-being in terms of people offering self-compassionate touch to themselves. I was interested in the synergy between thinking self-compassionate thoughts and doing this embodied form of self-compassionate touch. It offers two potential ways of regulating yourself. I should also say that we told participants they could choose other forms of touch, like stroking yourself on the cheeks or giving yourself a hug. What's most important is that the method of touch supports you in feeling compassionately toward yourself. I was surprised that the majority of students who participated in the study said they were too busy to do this 20-second practice every day. What's that about? Well, I was just joking with a friend about this, and she said that when people are stressed, they can get wrapped up in feeling like they can't take 20 seconds to pause. It might be more a mindset than a reality, but there is more work to be done on how to help people feel like those 20 seconds are going to make a difference in their lives. We wash our hands for 20 seconds. We brush our teeth for 2 minutes. Why not take 20 seconds to do this? Do you have any advice on how people can make this practice a habit? Well, it can be helpful to choose a cue. You can practice after morning coffee in the living room, or whenever you're feeling stressed, if you can get yourself to do it then. The more specific you are in describing your cue and developing your plan, the more likely you are to develop the practice into a habit. Well, does this research suggest that there is no reason to do a longer practice? Well, most of the participants in our study were novice meditators or people who had never meditated before, so we don't know how this would look with people who have a really dedicated meditation practice or are very experienced with meditation. Rigorous research is needed for whether shorter practices have advantages over longer practices and for whom those advantages may be most pronounced. Also, just like brushing teeth is not a replacement for going to the dentist, this micropractice should not be a replacement for therapy or more intensive mental health care. The next article is titled, Experts Say Medicaid Rebate Change is Behind Inhaler Price Cuts, by Laura Klassen, Tribune News Service. A recent tweak to a Medicaid formula could be behind the shakeup to inhaler products, a series of changes that have both benefited and harmed patients with asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or COPD. Three of the four major inhaler manufacturers have announced plans to cap patient copays for all their inhalers at $35 a month in recent weeks, in addition to lowering the list prices of some of those products. But one drug maker also withdrew two popular children's inhalers from the market, and the alternative is in short supply. Boehringer Ingelheim, AstraZeneca PLC, and GlaxoSmithKline, also known as GSK PLC, all announced the $35 monthly copay cap, which could significantly extend the impact of their current patient assistance programs. The companies have simultaneously cut list prices. That's the initial price before health plans negotiate discounts and rebates for some, but not all, of their inhalers. The drug companies say they've made the changes because they're committed to helping patients. Some Democrats on Capitol Hill say it happened because of public pressure. But some drug pricing experts are pointing to a recent change in the formula of Medicaid's mandatory drug rebate program as the reason. It's the same reason experts pointed to when insulin manufacturers lowered their list prices, although those reductions were more widespread. The rebate change can force drug makers to actually pay Medicaid in some cases if list prices on older products outpace inflation. The effect is less severe on asthma products than it was on insulin, thanks to a 2009 ban on a common propellant found in old inhalers. That resulted in a wave of new inhalers with new patents. Because the change to the Medicaid rebate formula penalizes older drugs with higher prices the most, the newer inhalers are less affected than older insulin products. Quote, "They're still playing the same game," said Anna Kaltenbeck, a former Senate Finance Committee staffer under Oregon Democrat Ron Wyden, who now leads ATI Advisory's prescription drug reimbursement practice. "It just brought the ceiling on the game down a little bit, and they're sort of diffusing it vis-a-vis the patients by giving them these copay coupons." The rebate change is tied to the change in list prices, though, not copays. Copay caps are important because they limit what patients pay, including, at least in this case, uninsured patients. But reducing list prices helps cut behind-the-scenes costs that are absorbed by the healthcare system. The rebate change took effect in January. GlaxoSmithKline in January reduced the list price for its Advair Diskus and Advair HFA inhalers, while AstraZeneca also reduced the list price of Symbicort. Boehringer Ingelheim is also planning to cut the list prices for Spiriva Handihaler and Atrovent HFA. Other factors, like Medicare's new penalty for raising prices faster than inflation, could also be driving the changes. Inhalers are prime examples, like insulin, of products where manufacturers have raised list prices over very long periods of time, said Will Feldman, a pulmonary doctor with Brigham and Women's Hospital and an instructor at Harvard Medical School. He pointed to Boehringer Ingelheim's decision to drop list prices on Spiriva Handihaler, an older inhaler that now faces generic competition, and not its newer product, Spiriva Respimat. That product is far less likely to be impacted by the Medicaid rebate cap policy change than Spiriva Handihaler, he said. Both Boehringer Ingelheim and AstraZeneca refuted the idea that the Medicaid rebate was behind the decision to cut list prices. Quote, "We continually look at market dynamics to assess what more we can do to address barriers to access and affordability of our medicines to help patients living with respiratory diseases lead healthier lives," said an AstraZeneca spokesperson. Not all the developments were positive for patients. GlaxoSmithKline in January also discontinued Flovent HFA and Flovent Diskus, two of the new inhalers approved for children. Insurance coverage for the authorized generics can vary, and the only other major alternative, Organon's Asmenex, is now in shortage because of an increased demand. Quote, "It's the perfect storm of what is wrong with our pharmaceutical system," said Feldman. "And the end result is patients in some cases are suffering and not getting the products they need." GlaxoSmithKline did not say whether the rebate was the driving factor behind its pricing changes or the decision to discontinue the two inhalers, saying it had been planning to discontinue the branded products for some time. Quote, "The price reductions build on our strong track record of increasing access and improving the affordability of its medicines, including an ongoing commitment to reasonable pricing," said a company spokesperson. Capping patient copays could greatly increase access to consumers as well, even though the drug makers already offer patient assistance programs. Kaltenbeck pointed to the ongoing access issues for insulin, despite the insulin makers' long-standing assistance programs. Quote, "We know that people were dying because they weren't getting insulin," she said, "which suggests to me that copay coupons and patient assistance programs aren't reaching people to the extent that you want them to be reached. Public pressure. Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Chairman Bernie Sanders, independent of Vermont, singled out the four major manufacturers in January as part of an investigation into inhaler prices. Recently, he took a victory lap in the wake of the drug makers' announcements to cap copays, saying, quote, "They're beginning to catch on to the fact that the American people are sick and tired of paying astronomical prices for the prescription drugs they need to stay alive." He acknowledged that the companies are only lowering list prices on some products, but stressed the importance of the copay caps to patients. He also attributed the drug companies' announcements to the committee's investigation and public backlash, rather than Medicaid's rebate program. Quote, "In this instance, we think it's public pressure," he said. Additionally, Sanders urged the last of the four major manufacturers that hasn't capped copays, Teva Pharmaceutical Industries Limited, to follow suit. The company is smaller and more focused on generics, he said, but he hoped Teva executives would come around. "They are considering it," he said. Teva did not respond to requests for comment. In November, the Federal Trade Commission warned a number of drug makers, including Teva and the other major inhaler manufacturers, that they had improperly listed patents in the Food and Drug Administration's registry, known as the Orange Book, which can help block competition from generic rivals. Teva was one of the several companies that refused to pull any of the patents the FTC challenged. Recently, the FTC took another step against the manufacturer, filing an amicus brief in a patent infringement suit Teva brought against Amneal Pharmaceuticals Incorporated for attempting to bring a generic version of its ProAir HFA to market. The FTC argues the patents that Teva is claiming are improperly listed. These issues underscore the broader dynamics that lawmakers and regulators still face in unwinding the tangled drug pricing system. "The copay caps are good for patients," said Feldman, "but it's not nearly enough." Quote, "It's a Band-Aid on a problematic drug pricing system in our country," he said. The next article is titled, "Colorectal Cancer is Rising Among Younger Adults. Some States Want to Boost Awareness," by Tim Henderson. Responding to new research on the rising incidence of colorectal cancer among younger adults, some states are trying to boost public awareness of the deadly disease, with a focus on Black and rural residents. In 2021, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force changed the routine screening age for colorectal cancer to 45 from 50, based on growing cases among younger adults. But many people, even younger, are finding themselves with life-threatening advanced cancer that could have been prevented with earlier detection. It's unclear why new generations are increasingly susceptible. Black and rural Americans are more likely to die from colorectal cancer at any age because they're less likely to get screening in time to save their lives. Using state and federal money, healthcare groups in Colorado, Delaware, Michigan, Mississippi, North Carolina, Texas, Washington State, and West Virginia have had some success in boosting screening rates. In Michigan, for example, healthcare groups last year surveyed Detroit area Black residents 40 and over and found that many mistakenly thought they didn't need colorectal cancer screenings if they didn't have any symptoms. The groups increased the screening rate by giving more information to patients and rolling out software to automatically alert providers to schedule screenings. West Virginia is considering a state version of a national program to raise more awareness among younger adults and their doctors, partly by bringing in trusted messengers in different communities to help spread the word, said Susan Eason, program director of the West Virginia Program to Increase Colorectal Cancer Screening. It's one of 35 state-level programs supported by federal, state, and local money, she said. With this on the rise, younger people need to be aware of symptoms, and providers also need to be aware. So when a patient presents with something like blood in the stool, they don't dismiss it as hemorrhoids, said Eason. Rural West Virginia residents face numerous barriers to screenings, including long distances on mountain roads to see doctors and a shortage of gastroenterologists and screening clinics that can mean a 6 to 9 month wait for an appointment. In addition, many residents have jobs that don't allow paid time off for seeking medical help. To help fill the gap, said Eason, her program is increasing access to chemical tests that can be done at home and sent by mail. However, an in-person colonoscopy is preferable because it can detect precancerous growths that doctors can remove. Two authors of a December report found that colorectal cancer is increasing with each generation and told Stateline that lowering the age for recommended screenings is less important than making sure that people actually get them. Quote, rather than lowering the age to initiate screening, I'd like to see us double down on our efforts to optimize screening participation, said Caitlin Murphy, an associate professor at the University of Texas Health Science Center in Houston. More than 1 in 3 adults 45 or older has not been screened, according to the American Cancer Society. The study's lead author, Samir Gupta, a gastroenterologist and professor at the University of San Diego, agreed. Gupta said people under 45 should consider a colonoscopy if they have a family history or red flag symptoms such as rectal bleeding, bloody stools, unexplained weight loss, and low iron anemia. Young survivors who spoke to Stateline said they initially ignored the symptoms or that the symptoms were misinterpreted by medical professionals who did not expect cancer in such young patients. Jamila Mahmoud, a nonprofit worker in Milwaukee, said she was misdiagnosed 4 times before a CAT scan showed a massive tumor blocking her colon in 2019 at the age of 33, with stage 3 cancer that had spread to her lymph nodes. She had complained of increasingly sharp abdominal pain for months, but was told only to avoid spicy foods and take antacids. Now cancer-free after surgery and 8 rounds of chemotherapy, Mahmoud, who is 37 and engaged to be married, said she tells people not to let doctors take their symptoms lightly. Quote, I always tell people, if you feel like someone's not listening to you, go somewhere else, because you're precious. You only have one life, she said. Rates of colorectal cancer deaths have been slowly decreasing for all ages since 1968. When they were around 28 per 100,000, to around 13 in 2023. However, deaths of patients 45 and younger as a share of colorectal cancer deaths have grown from 2.5% in 1976 to 3.8% in 2023. It's according to a Stateline analysis of federal mortality data kept by the Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. From 2018 to early 2024, colorectal cancer death rates for all ages and for those under 45 have been highest in West Virginia and Mississippi, consistent with research showing that rural residents have a greater chance of dying from colorectal cancer. Kentucky, Oklahoma, Arkansas, Maine, Tennessee, and Vermont also had high rates for all ages and for younger people. The lowest rates were in Connecticut, Massachusetts, Utah, Colorado, and New York State. Rural areas have the highest rates of colorectal cancer deaths, according to the Stateline analysis. Rates are 42% higher for the most rural areas compared with the most urban areas. In his mid-20s and living in rural North Carolina without health insurance, Jacob J.J. Singleton didn't think about cancer at all when he had painful bowel movements leading up to his 2015 diagnosis of stage 4 cancer that had spread to his liver and lungs. Quote, "In my 20s, you know, I just thought I was invincible," said Singleton. "I told myself it was a pulled muscle because I was doing CrossFit training." Eventually, his parents prevailed on him to see a doctor when he could feel a pulsating mass in his abdomen that turned out to be a tumor. Later testing revealed that Singleton had a genetic disorder called Lynch syndrome that put him at increasingly high risk for fast-growing colorectal cancer. But he didn't know or suspect that at the time. Quote, "There's not a lot of medical history in my family," Singleton said. "In my family, guys don't go to the doctor much. You get through and don't complain. If you get sick, you just hope it gets better. It's like it's God will is the way they think of it." But even in big cities where residents have easier access to health care, it's possible for early symptoms to get overlooked. David Thau, a political fundraiser in Washington, D.C., was diagnosed at 34 in 2019 with a cancerous tumor that had broken through the walls of his colon. Quote, "If there had been some kind of awareness campaign, some kind of posters in my doctor's office, or other places where a 30-year-old could look and see, these are symptoms of colon cancer, I would have gotten this checked out much sooner," said Thau. And the next article is titled, "Telehealth Sites Promise Cure for Male Menopause Despite FDA Ban on Off-Label Ads," by Michael Scaturo. Online stores sprang up during the COVID-19 pandemic's telehealth boom, touting testosterone as a cure-all for men's age-related diseases, despite FDA rules issued years ago restricting such low testosterone advertising. In ads on Google, Facebook, and elsewhere, testosterone telemedicine websites may promise a quick fix for sluggishness and low libido in men. But evidence for that is lacking, said physicians. And the midlife malaise for which testosterone is being touted as a solution is more likely caused by chronic medical conditions such as poor diet or a sedentary lifestyle. In fact, doctors urge caution, and the FDA recommends that all testosterone supplements carry a warning that they may increase the risk of heart attack and stroke. Now, valid medical reasons do exist for treating some men with testosterone. The hormone as a medication has existed for decades, and today's patients include men with hypogonadism, some transgender men who use it to help transition physically, and sometimes women dealing with menopausal symptoms. It has also been used for decades by bodybuilders and athletes to enhance strength. However, online dispensaries can overplay the idea of what is sometimes called male menopause or even manopause to drive sales of highly profitable testosterone-boosting injectables, often ignoring safety guidelines that should prevent healthy men from using the hormone. And some of the websites target military veterans. Quote, "I have seen ads online that do cross the line," said Stephen Nissen, a physician and the chief academic officer for the Heart, Vascular, and Thoracic Institute at the Cleveland Clinic. Quote, "For mood and low energy, prescribing testosterone provides little to no benefit. They are promoting testosterone for indications that are not on the label. And those who use it also risk having to take testosterone medication indefinitely because testosterone replacement therapy can cause the body to cease its own production of the hormone. And that's all the time we have for in this week's look at For Your Health. If you have any questions about this or other programs on Chris Radio, call the Chris Listener line at 860-727-9579. That's 860 727-9579. I'm Beth Gibbs. So long until next time.
This is Barbara Foster with Diabetes Update. Protein supplement helps control type 2 diabetes. Source, Newcastle University. Drinking a small amount of whey protein before meals has been shown to help people with type 2 diabetes control their blood sugars. In a study which holds potential for dietary management of the condition, people with type 2 diabetes drank a pre-made shot before meals which contained a low dose of whey protein. They were monitored for a week as they went about normal daily life. To compare the potential benefits of whey protein, the same participants also spent a week drinking a control shot that contained no protein in order to measure the results against each other. Results from continuous glucose monitoring revealed that glucose levels were much better controlled when taking the whey supplement before meals. On average, they had 2 hours extra per day of normal blood sugar levels compared to the no-protein week. In addition, their daily blood glucose levels were 0.6 millimoles per liter lower compared to when they consumed the supplement without any protein. Dr. Daniel West, senior lecturer and principal investigator working within the Human Nutrition Research Center and Diabetes Research Group at Newcastle University, UK, said, "While previous studies for a few hours in the lab have shown the potential for this dietary intervention, this is the first time that people have been monitored as they go about normal life. We believe the whey protein works in two ways. Firstly, by slowing down how quickly food passes through the digestive system, and secondly, by stimulating a number of important hormones that prevent the blood sugars climbing so high. As we see growing numbers of people around the world developing diabetes, investigating the potential of alternatives to drugs such as food supplements becomes more important." 18 people with type 2 diabetes consumed a small drink in a 100 milliliter shot with 15 grams of protein 10 minutes before breakfast, lunch, and dinner over 7 days and remained on their prescribed diabetes medication. Continuous glucose monitoring automatically tracked blood glucose levels over the course of the week. Newcastle University PhD student Kieran Smith, who oversaw the glucose monitoring and analyzed the data, said, "People were able to stick to the regime and liked the idea of having a convenient, tasty, small, pre-made drink that could be carried with them and taken before meals." The team intended to further explore the benefits of non-medical interventions, running the study on a larger scale and for a longer period of up to 6 months. They also plan to look at alternative proteins, such as those that come from plant sources like peas, fungi, and potatoes, to open up options for vegan and religious dietary needs. The Paired Perils of Breast Cancer and Diabetes. Source, University of California, San Diego. Breast cancer and type 2 diabetes would seem to be distinctly different diseases with commonality only in their commonality. Breast cancer is the second most diagnosed malignancy after some types of skin cancer. Approximately 1 in 8 U.S. women will develop invasive breast cancer over the course of their lifetime. More than 10% of the U.S. population has diabetes, with an estimated 2 in 5 Americans expected to develop the chronic disease during their lifetime. However, past research has uncovered associations between the two diseases. Women with diabetes, for example, have a 20 to 27% increased risk of developing breast cancer. Insulin resistance, a key characteristic of diabetes, has been associated with breast cancer incidence and poor survival. Population studies suggest diabetes risk begins to increase 2 years after a breast cancer diagnosis, and by 10 years post-diagnosis, the risk is 20% higher in breast cancer survivors than in age-matched women without breast cancer. But these epidemiological linkages are not clear-cut or definitive, and some studies have found no associations at all. In a new paper, a research team led by scientists at University of California, San Diego School of Medicine describe a possible biological mechanism connecting the two diseases in which breast cancer suppresses the production of insulin, resulting in diabetes, and the impairment of blood sugar control promotes tumor growth. No disease is an island because no cell lives alone, said corresponding study author Shizhen Emily Wang, Ph.D., professor of pathology at UC San Diego School of Medicine. In this study, we describe how breast cancer cells impair the function of pancreatic islets to make them produce less insulin than needed, leading to higher blood glucose levels in breast cancer patients compared to females without cancer. Wang said the study was inspired by early work and guidance from Gerald Olefsky, MD, professor of medicine and associate dean for scientific affairs in the Division of Endocrinology and Metabolism at UC San Diego School of Medicine. Olefsky is a co-senior author of the study with Wang. The culprit, according to Wang and Olefsky, are extracellular vesicles, EV, hollow spheres secreted or shed by cells that transport DNA, RNA, proteins, fats, and other materials between cells, a sort of cargo communication system. In this case, the cancer cells were found to be secreting microRNA 122 into the vesicles. Wang said, when vesicles reach the pancreas, they can enter the islet cells responsible for insulin production, dispense their MIR-122 cargo, and damage the islet's critical function in maintaining a normal blood glucose level. Cancer cells have a sweet tooth, Wang said. They use more glucose than healthy cells in order to fuel tumor growth, and this has been the basis for PET scans in cancer detection. By increasing blood glucose that can be easily used by cancer cells, breast tumors make their own favorite food and, meanwhile, deprive this essential nutrient from normal cells. The research was conducted using mouse models, which found that slow-releasing insulin pellets or a glucose-lowering drug known as an SGLT2 inhibitor restored normal control of glucose in the presence of a breast tumor, which in turn suppressed the tumor's growth. These findings support a greater need for diabetes screening and prevention among breast cancer patients and survivors, said Wang, noting that an inhibitor of MIR-122 developed by Regulus Therapeutics Incorporated in San Diego is currently in clinical trial as a potential treatment for chronic hepatitis C. It has been found to be effective in restoring normal insulin production and suppressing tumor growth in mouse models of breast cancer. These MIR-122 inhibitors, which happen to be the first miRNA-based drugs to enter clinical trials, might have a new use in breast cancer therapy, Wang said. Further hope for BCG vaccine in stemming type 1 diabetes. Source, Massachusetts General Hospital. At the recent 2021 annual scientific sessions of the American Diabetes Association, researchers from Massachusetts General Hospital, MGH, presented positive updates on their trials of the Bacillus Calmette-Guerin BCG vaccine to safely and significantly lower blood sugars. In type 1 diabetes, an autoimmune disease which currently has no cure, T cells attack the pancreas and destroy its ability to create insulin, a hormone vital in allowing glucose to enter cells to produce energy. In prior work, Denise Faustman, MD, PhD, director of the MGH Immunobiology Laboratory, and colleagues have found that BCG boosts a substance called TNF, which eliminates the harmful T cells and aids development of beneficial ones called regulatory T cells or Tregs. Key findings include new understanding in how response to BCG vaccination differs depending on a patient's age of onset and additional support for the role of BCG vaccination to alter glucose transport and change Tregs. Currently, 143 type 1 diabetics have received at least two doses of BCG, including 25 patients enrolled in a recently launched trial of adults who had pediatric onset. pending FDA approval, MGH aims to launch a multi-center pediatric trial later this year. More data from randomized double-blinded clinical trials will be reported as we move towards additional readout of the Phase 2 trial, says Faustman, principal investigator of BCG clinical trials at MGH. We have continued evidence of BCG's ability to reset and restore the immune system. In 2018, MGH published results of the follow-up of Phase 1 trial of BCG-treated long-term diabetic participants showing lasting, clinically and statistically significant drops in HbA1c values that persisted with 8 years of follow-up. The new data presented at the ADA would include type 1 diabetics with age of onset younger than 21 years have a faster response time and greater change in HbA1c than adult onset type 1 diabetics. Over a period of 3 years, BCG returns gene expression in Tregs in type 1 diabetics to a pattern consistent with non-type 1 control subjects. The HbA1c response at 2 years in juvenile onset subjects is consistent with the 3-year response seen in the Phase 1 study. BCG is an old vaccine, but it seems to be presenting new gifts, says Nigel Curtis, MD, PhD, of the Murdoch Children's Research Institute in Melbourne, Australia. He directs global clinical trials on the beneficial and off-target effects of the BCG vaccine, but was not involved in the current study. This new data from MGH adds the growing understanding of how BCG changes the way the body responds to autoimmune and infectious disease. Loneliness predicts development of type 2 diabetes. Source, King's College London. Published in the journal Diabetologia, the Journal of the American Association for the Study of Diabetes, EASD, the study shows that it is the absence of quality connections with people and not the lack of contact that predicts the onset of type 2 diabetes, suggesting that helping people form and experience positive relationships could be a useful tool in prevention strategies for type 2 diabetes. The results have implications in light of recent findings that people with diabetes are at greater risk of dying from COVID-19. The study indicates that prolonged loneliness may influence the development of diabetes, suggesting the experience of lockdown could potentially compound people's vulnerability in this pandemic if the loneliness continues for some time. Loneliness occurs when an individual perceives that their social needs are not being met and reflects an imbalance between desired and actual social relationships. A fifth of adults in the UK and a third of adults in the US report feeling lonely sometimes. There is a growing interest in the role of loneliness in the health, and previous research has associated loneliness with increased risk of death and heart disease. This is the first study to investigate the experience of loneliness with later onset of type 2 diabetes. The study analyzed data from the English Longitudinal Study Aging on 4,112 adults aged 50 years and over, which was collected at several times from 2002 to 2017. At the start of data collection, all participants were free of diabetes and had normal levels of blood glucose. The study showed that over a period of 12 years, 264 people developed type 2 diabetes, and the level of loneliness measured at the start of data collection was a significant predictor of the onset of type 2 diabetes later in life. This relationship remained intact when accounting for smoking, alcohol, weight, level of blood glucose, high blood pressure, and cardiovascular disease. The association was also independent of depression, living alone, and social isolation. Lead author Dr. Ruth Hackett from the Institute of Psychiatry, Psychology, and Neuroscience, IOPPN, King's College, London, said The study shows a strong relationship between loneliness and the later onset of type 2 diabetes. What is particularly striking is that this relationship is robust even when factors that are important in diabetes development are taken into account, such as smoking, alcohol intake, and blood glucose, as well as mental health factors such as depression. The study also demonstrates a clear distinction between loneliness and social isolation, in that isolation or living alone does not predict type 2 diabetes, whereas loneliness, which is defined by a person's quality of relationships, does. She continued, I came up with the idea for the research during UK lockdown for the COVID-19 pandemic as I became increasingly aware and interested in how loneliness may affect our health, especially as it is likely that many more people were experiencing this difficult emotion during this period. According to the study, a possible biological reason behind the association between loneliness and type 2 diabetes could be the impact of constant loneliness on the biological system responsible for stress, which, over time, affects the body and increases the risk for diabetes. If the feeling of loneliness becomes chronic, explained Dr. Hackett, then every day you're stimulating the stress system, and over time, that leads to wear and tear on your body, and those negative changes in stress-related biology may be linked to type 2 diabetes development. Another explanation for the findings could be biases in our thinking that may perpetuate the association between loneliness and diabetes, as when people feel lonely, they expect people will react to them negatively, which makes it more difficult to form good relationships. Common diabetes drug reverses inflammation in the liver. Source, Salk Institute. The diabetes drug metformin, derived from a lilac plant that's been used medicinally for more than 1,000 years, has been prescribed to hundreds of millions of people worldwide as the frontline treatment for type 2 diabetes. Yet scientists don't fully understand how the drug is so effective at controlling blood glucose. Now, researchers at the Salk Institute have shown the importance of specific enzymes in the body for metformin's function. In addition, the new work showed that the same proteins, regulated by metformin, controlled aspects of inflammation in mice, something the drug has not typically been prescribed for. Apart from clarifying how metformin works, the research, which appeared in the journal Genes and Development on September 10, 2020, has relevance for many other inflammatory diseases. These findings let us dig into precisely what metformin is doing at a molecular level, says Ruben Shaw, a professor in Salk's Molecular and Cell Biology Laboratory and the senior author of the new paper. This is more granular understanding of the drug is more important because there is increasing interest in targeting these pathways for not only diabetes, but immune diseases and cancer. Researchers have known for 20 years that metformin activates a metabolic master switch, a protein called AMPK, which conserves a cell's energy under low nutrient conditions and which is activated naturally in the body following exercise. 12 years ago, Shaw discovered that in many healthy cells, AMPK starts a cascade effect, regulating two proteins called RAPTOR and TSC2, which results in a block of the central pro-growth protein complex called MTORC1, mammalian target of rapamycin complex 1. These findings helped explain the ability of metformin to inhibit the growth of tumor cells, an area of research that began to generate excitement after Shaw and others connected AMPK to a bona fide cancer gene in the early 2000s. But in the intervening years, many additional proteins and pathways that metformin regulates have been discovered, drawing into question which of the targets of metformin are most important for different beneficial consequences of metformin treatment. Indeed, metformin is currently entering clinical trials in the United States as a general anti-aging treatment because its effects are so well established from millions of patients and its side effects are minimal. But whether AMPK or its targets, Raptor or TSC2, are important for different effects of metformin remains poorly understood. In the new work in mice, Shaw and his colleagues genetically disconnected the master protein AMPK from the other proteins so they could not receive signals from AMPK, but were able to otherwise function normally and receive input from other proteins. When these mice were put on a high-fat diet triggering diabetes and then treated with metformin, the drug no longer had the same effects on liver cells as it did in normally diabetic animals, suggesting that communication between AMPK and mTORC1 is crucial for metformin to work. By looking at genes regulated in the liver, the researchers found that when AMPK couldn't communicate with Raptor or TSC2, metformin's effects on hundreds of genes was blocked. Some of these genes were related to lipid fat metabolism, helping explain some of metformin's beneficial effects. But surprisingly, many others were linked to inflammation. Metformin, the genetic data showed, normally turned on anti-inflammatory pathways, and these effects required AMPK, TSC2, and Raptor. We didn't go looking for a role in inflammation, so for it to come up so strongly was surprising, says Salk postdoctoral fellow and first author Janine Van Nostrand. People suffering from obesity and diabetes often exhibit chronic inflammation, which further leads to additional weight gain and other maladies, including heart disease and stroke. Therefore, identifying an important role for metformin and the interrelationship between AMPK and mTORC1 in control of both blood glucose and inflammation reveals how metformin can treat metabolic diseases by multiple means. Metformin and exercise elicit similar beneficial outcomes, and research has previously shown that AMPK helps mediate some of the positive effects of exercise on the body. So among other questions, Shaw and Van Nostrand are interested in exploring whether Raptor and TSC2 are involved in the many beneficial effects of exercise as well. If turning on AMPK and shutting off mTORC1 are responsible for some of the systemic benefits of exercise, that means we might be able to better mimic this with new therapeutics designed to mimic some of those effects, says Shaw, who holds the William R. Body Chair. In the meantime, the new data suggests that researchers should study the potential use of metformin in inflammatory diseases, particularly those involving liver inflammation. The findings also point toward AMPK, Raptor, and TSC2 more broadly as potential targets in inflammatory conditions, suggesting the need for deeper investigation of metformin, as well as newer AMPK agonists and mTOR inhibitors, the researchers say. Metformin for type 2 diabetes patients or not? Researchers now have the answer. Source, Lund University. Metformin is the first-line drug that can lower blood sugar levels in type 2 diabetes patients. 1/3 of patients do not respond to metformin treatment, and 5% experience serious side effects, which is the reason many choose to stop medicating. Researchers at Lund University in Sweden have now identified biomarkers that can show in advance how the patient will respond to metformin treatment via a simple blood test. Our study constitutes an important step towards the goal of personalized care for diabetes patients because it can contribute to ensuring that the right person receives the right care as soon as there is a diagnosis, says Charlotte Ling, professor of epigenetics at Lund University, who led the study. When diet and exercise are not enough to regulate blood sugar, metformin is the first drug introduced to treat type 2 diabetes, according to international guidelines. If it does not have the intended effect in the form of lowered blood sugar levels, or if the patient experiences serious side effects, patients then go on to trial other drugs. If it takes a long time for the patient to receive the correct treatment, there is a risk of complications due to the elevated blood sugar levels. Approximately 30% of all patients with type 2 diabetes do not respond to metformin and should be given another drug right from the start. For this reason, it is important to be able to identify these patients upon diagnosis, says Charlotte Ling. One-third of patients experience side effects, usually in the form of gastrointestinal difficulties, such as nausea, stomach pain, and diarrhea. 5% stop taking the medicine due to severe side effects. The study is the first pharmacogenic study in diabetes, i.e., that researchers have studied how epigenetic factors, such as DNA methylation, can be used as biomarkers to predict the effect of a drug. To a certain extent, pharmacogenics has been used within cancer care to predict how a person will respond to a treatment. However, it has never been done in diabetes care before, says Charlotte Ling. Researchers in the study have looked at epigenetic modifications, so-called DNA methylations, in blood from individuals diagnosed with diabetes before they started taking metformin. In a follow-up a year later, the researchers could see which patients had benefited from the treatment, with resulting lowered blood sugar levels, and whether or not they had suffered from side effects. By compiling the responses, we have found biomarkers that can identify already at diagnosis of diabetes which patients will benefit from and tolerate metformin, which will advance personalized therapy in type 2 diabetes, says the study's first author, Sonia Garcia Calzone. The study was conducted on 363 participants from three different patient cohorts, all new diabetics in Skåne, all new diabetics in Uppsala, and optimed from Latvia. As a next step, the researchers are planning for a new clinical study in which they will repeat the study with a larger patient group. 1,000 patients will be invited to participate from all around the world. Study reveals genetic clusters and biological pathways that may explain differences in type 2 diabetes risk, source Mass General Hospital. The development and progression of type 2 diabetes are affected by numerous biological processes, such as the body's response to insulin, the health of insulin-producing pancreatic beta cells, and the functioning of metabolic pathways. In a recent study published in Nature Medicine that analyzed individuals from diverse backgrounds, a team led by investigators at Mass General Hospital and the Broad Institute of MIT and Harvard identified various genetic clusters involved in a broad range of biological mechanisms that may help explain ancestry-associated differences in type 2 diabetes clinical presentations. Our study shows that the genetic underpinnings of type 2 diabetes can help explain clinical differences across populations, says co-lead author Kirk Smith, MS, a computational biologist in MGH's Center for Genomic Medicine. Also, the genetic mechanisms of disease that we have identified offer the potential to guide development of curative therapies, adds co-lead author Aaron J. Deutsch, MD, an instructor in the Division of Endocrinology at MGH.
This is Barbara Foster.